This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Welcome. It's the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. For those of you who can tell the difference, because Ken Stauer, the station manager, has told me repeatedly he can't tell the difference between Stefan and mine's voice, this is Darren Kaster back in the host chair this week. A, because I'm feeling a bit better, and B, also because Stefan is away. So that's convenient. It's actually a bit of an empty studio today. I have just the really hardcore volunteers here with me this week. Stefan's away. I don't know. I think he's like a Canada's Wonderland or something. MA, of course, is off saving the world. Deirdre is doing something super important. I can't remember exactly what she said. She's probably also saving the world, or she's with Stefan at Canada's Wonderland. One or the other. Vancouver. All right. Let's not you know, give away too much of her privacy. I'm sure she's doing something very important. But we do have the super hardcore dedicated Alex Ritchie, who's in there in the tech room as well on the board. We'll be jumping in occasionally to help support as well. And Sabina Hasseni, who's also sitting in studio with me here across the table as well. They're going to be jumping in a fair bit throughout the program today as we talk a little bit about a few things. I have reserved a good news more or less section at the end of the program. For those of you who need a little pick-me-up, there's like some sort of good news in that qualifier sort of way that like everything we say on the show that's good news always has an asterisk next to it. You know, within the parameters of what's normal for this program, there's good news section at the end, so stay tuned for that. We're also going to be talking about some non-oil things. I've specifically grouped those for the middle section of the program. As well, we have there's some reporting that's being done on Ontario's climate change plan. There's some interesting, somewhat terrifying overview. Something I was more or less aware of, but I think that we haven't spoken about in quite some time. So we'll bring up again on the program about Canada's regulatory agencies, Health Canada specifically, and cosmetics as well. So this includes both cosmetics and just like, you know, body products in general. Not great, but of course we're going to start with what else? Oil. So there's four things I want to run through here quickly. One of them, let's touch on Fort McMurray just really quickly, because there's just a small sort of addition to that story. So it's been all of the news, and of course we've been talking about it as well, that there was, of course, a massive fire. If you've not heard about this massive fire, you've been under a rock, and just go back in the program. I'm not going to, you know, or read any newspaper for the past month. And we won't review that. However, there is new information coming out, which, again, if you're familiar with these types of topics and you've been covering this for a while, you will not be surprised. But some sort of more casual observers or new listeners to this program may not realize that in some cases, depending on where you are, frequently after a major fire, major fires remove, of course, a lot of ground cover. So it removes a lot of brush, it removes a lot of things with roots, it removes a lot of trees, basically a lot of things that hold soil still. And this is one of those other consequences, whether we lose them to fire or lose them to bugs or lose them to climate change, land use issues, and particularly things like mudslides can in fact be correlated and have a causal relationship with fires and global warming changes in general. So what we're looking at now is that up to 66 millimeters of rain expected in the Fort McMurray area could now result in washed out rivers and creeks and culverts, potentially disastrous erosion of soil, damaging the trees that haven't burned down, and of course danger to humans, both through damaged or collapsing buildings, so again ones that haven't already been destroyed by fire, but could also just create, you know, mudslides, terrible road conditions, other dangerous impacts. So not a lot of news there as far as a development. Nothing has happened, but we're anticipating more things to happen, and just more because, like, you know, as the flashy images of the flames stop being so readily available. So a lot of the time, these news stories will in fact leave the front page of the paper and be relegated to later sections of the paper or disappear entirely. And this is not a quick cleanup, as it were, which provides me a segue to my next story. But I want to offer any chance to jump in before I move on here. No, we're good. Okay, so we're moving on. So the next thing was there was a good article, and I actually saw, I think somebody was doing some tagline borrowing here because I saw a number of articles that had very similar, from different sources that had very similar titles, which would make sense except for this title, which was, bet you didn't hear about a bunch of Shell oil spills in the Gulf last month. So regardless of the overlap, someone must have done a report and a bunch of other news agencies picked it up and none of them were terribly creative with their news headlines. The point of the article and why it was interesting, though, was that something, and again, we've this is something that happens a lot, but as I just said with the last story, something we've talked about before, but doesn't come up all the time, was there's actually a threshold. A lot of people don't know, and I know that many do, but I know a lot of activists aren't even super clear on what happens when oil spills. So there's a couple of really important things. It's a short read. It's a good read. I recommend pulling it up. We'll, of course, link to it in the show notes after the program. But I will just highlight a couple of interesting points here, which is that, first of all, there is no, I don't know if you know this, we don't have Skynet yet. So computers don't know everything automatically. So how do we find out about an oil spill? That's a very good question, one that I don't think we've spoken about at length much. Oil spills are self-reported, which means that Shell, BP, and whoever, they inform the government and the regulators when there is, in fact, a spill. Now, you could say, well, how are you supposed to hide an oil spill? You know, that's now, come on, you're being ridiculous, Darren. No, but the thing is, they happen all the time. They happen all the time. They don't always get cleaned up right away. And sometimes you could have, five or six spills from one site. Maybe the first one gets reported. Who knows if the next four do? And the thing is that the government just doesn't have the resources to provide that sort of oversight. So even right at the thing, and imagine now, Sabina, imagine how many oil spills we've spoken about. You haven't even been on the program that long, and how many oil spills have we spoken about on this program? All of those, the ones that get media attention, are the ones that we find out about all, are ones that pass a Coast Guard threshold, this is in the U.S., of 100,000 gallons is the threshold for major spill. And below that, basically, they don't get reported. Sometimes they don't get reported to, they get less regulatory oversight, less money for cleanup, less scientific sampling. And here's the thing, because it's self-reporting and there's a threshold, so we had one last month that was 11,000 gallons short of that, so in the 90,000 gallon range. And this is entirely self-reported, and there's absolutely no way to check it. So there's a few ways that they check for oil spills. One of them is that they estimate the amount of oil by the color. So if there's a rainbow pattern on the top, they know it's a certain, was it micrometer, something like that. And if it's a little darker brown, then they know it's this within this range. So it's a huge guessing game. It's not like they have a valve on the pipe, which would be the way you would assume they would do it, was there's the valve on the pipe, we had a certain amount of pressure lost, and so we know that this much oil escaped. No, they can't do that. That's the thing that makes the most sense and would seem to be the most obvious way to do it, apparently, is either difficult or expensive because they don't do that. What they do is they do this weird guessing game with the color of the oil on the water. Of course, forgetting the fact that weather can move this stuff away. It's all self-reported, often by a single flyby by helicopter done visually. So not with some sort of fancy like laser technology. Someone just kind of looks down and says, it looks this color. It's covering about a hectare on the surface. So we're going to, pocket math, carry the one, and we got about this many gallons. So this doesn't account for dispersal. This doesn't account for the amount that doesn't get to the water. This doesn't account for the fact that it's an incredibly imprecise guessing game. And this doesn't account for the fact that, as the article here points out, it's not, we can't say that there's ever been any fraud here. We can't say with any certainty that there has been. We can't say that with any certainty there's ever been a single case of fraud. However, it would be pretty easy, and they do have a giant incentive to, self-report just under that limit, because then nobody finds out about it, never makes it to the newspaper. Sure, maybe they have to pay a tiny bit more of the cleanup costs, but because nobody knows what the actual spill is, they can just, not actually clean it up. They can just spend the amount of money for the size of the spill they had to, or they said they had, rather than the one they actually had, and then just walk away as the rest sinks to the bottom of the ocean. And the very last thing on this before we move on is that a lot of the time the sorry, where was I? There's an appearance code talking about that. Sorry, there was one more thing. I lost my train of thought here. Here was the thing. So here is a good example to wrap this up. So during the Deepwater Horizon scale, I'm now quoting from the end of the article. Even during the Deepwater Horizon disaster, BP was forced to quintuple its estimate of wellhead's daily flow rate from 1,000 barrels a day to 5,000. Not because of a government investigation or reassessment, not because of internal corrections or a change in flow, but because of satellite and radar data collected by a tiny independent nonprofit called SkyTruth. So if we even take that as an average, let's say that's average. That means that there are frequently spills that never get reported because they're under 100,000, or they get reported and nobody notices because they're under 100,000. We could very well multiply every reported spill ever by five, and that could be an average for all we know. Now, who's to say this is all guessing game? But the point is, guaranteed, an absolute green majority guarantee. You've never heard about the vast majority of oil spills. Guaranteed. Don't care how plugged in you are. You've never heard of the vast majority of the oil spills. Number two, another green majority guarantee. There's zero chance that the reporting on many of these, if not all of these spills, have had accurate amounts. So when we're talking about all these other things, and we're going to talk about some good news with qualifiers a little bit later when Alex jumps in with us here, and we'll dig a bit more in, but just that, like, that every time we have these conversations about, well, they're going to do this stuff and we'll talk about some good news later and whatever, it's like the amount of bad this causes on a regular basis is here's the thing. It's not factored in. It's not factored in when people are talking about the value of solar panels. It's not factored in when we're talking about the environmental impacts. They barely end to a pathetic degree even factoring in climate change. But even without climate change, there are disastrous regular problems to health, wealth, and happiness caused by oil that you've never heard of. And it's almost certainly worse, even if you did hear about it, than what you were told. And I'm going to trail off there. Sabina.
I think this topic is extremely interesting, not only because of what an oil spill does to the ecological impact of the environment, also the health and mental impact of the people living around there. But what's really interesting is that during the BP oil spill, when they were recovering, like when they were trying to mitigate the efforts and try to recover and clean up the spill, more carbon dioxide was released into the atmosphere through the recovery or through the remediation of the oil spill, because one of the ways that they were doing this was just literally burning the Gulf of Mexico. They were just burning it off so that the oil would be removed. And that there was and what's really interesting as well is that a lot of companies jumped on this bandwagon, and you've seen some commercials where they take the duck or whatever, and it's completely drowned in oil, and they put this chemical on it, and they say, oh, we're cleaning. It's like, it's if it's safe for this, it's safe for anything. And that chemical actually ended up being 10 times worse than...
Of course the duck is dead.
So... So I mean, these oil spills, not only do we not hear about them, but even though they're ecologically really, really harmful, not a lot of people hear about them, but just also the remediation efforts and the cleanup efforts are just as bad for the environment as the spill. So it's kind of like a double whammy.
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing, and we're going to get into it. You know, I have two more here. We may or may not get to both before the break, but... In the next one here, another one here in, this is from Vancouver Observer, or National Observer rather, Canadian oilists fear running a lemonade stand with only one customer. And this is talking about the CAPP, Canadian Association for Petroleum Producers, lobbyist lead, vice president of communications, aka head lobbyist, Jeff Gowlin from CAP. Talking to a trade meeting and, you know, laying out the case for, yes, we take climate change very seriously, but, you know, we have no choice but to build at least one pipeline, which is interesting. I want to pause there for a minute before we go on and maybe get you guys to jump in. So, and we'll go to Alex for this first because you're the newbiest one on the long term of this. So to you, like my feeling here and my initial thing here, because they're literally saying that, like he says a few times in this article, we're gonna have, you know, we'd like it, we should build many, but we're gonna have to build one. And it was very cautiously phrased that way. And what I took away, and I want to know if I'm reading too much into this in your opinion, was that there seems to be an admission, okay, fine, you got us. We'll probably only get one. And they're saying, like, we don't want to say we'll only take one, because if we can get more, for instance, if we get the Liberals out in the next election, we get some conservatives back in who want to build even more than Justin Trudeau does, maybe we'll get more. So we don't want to preemptively say, well, we only need one. But it seems to, it sounds like a concession to me. What do you think, Alex? We'll go to Spina after.
I didn't get a chance to read the article. What do they mean exactly by the lemonade stand with only one?
Oh, so I'll get to that. So forget about the lemonade stand thing for a second. But just the idea that, you know, there's several pipelines on the table, and he's saying, you know, well, we have to have one. Am I reading too much into it that sounds like they're conceding that the environmentalists won a little bit and may have gotten them to sort of preemptively accept a single one? They don't want to admit it because they don't want to take away the chance that they might get more than one. But they seem to be saying, fine, okay, we'll call a truce. Give us one pipeline and we'll work with you.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
It sounds like a classic bartering situation.
And, a little bit.
And they're realizing that they're not going to get the deal that they're looking for in the market. So they're trying to at least sneak their one pipeline through. I don't know whether you're reading too much into it or not.
But it does sound a little bit like a concession.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
if we know we're hearing from a lobbyist who's the vice president of communications. That sounds like a vice president of communications version of a slight concession.
Right. And now would be the chance for environmentalists to say, no pipelines this time. We're going to win this one.
Yeah. Well, and that's frequently what happens. As soon as you start winning a fight that nobody thought you'd win, everybody rushes to your side, right? It's like in the schoolyard, if the tiny kid, you know, bops the bully in the nose and makes his nose bleed, all of a sudden everybody's on the little kid's side, right? And so I think it's that. And yeah, now they're like, oh, we can be best friends now. I'm like, no, I'm going to hit you again, actually. Sabina, what do you think?
No, I completely agree. And I think, I mean, when it comes to, you just said it's VP of communications, he's very well trained. I can tell you, I'm sure he's done a lot of school in which he can make his words sound very, very convincing to people. And coming from, you know, a business background, they really teach you exactly how to say the words that you need to say in order to kind of please everyone in the room. And I think they're doing exactly that. He's saying, okay, well, you know what? We'll just do one pipeline to please the environmentalists and also to please whatever they're sharing. Shareholders. They're kind of just trying to have it all. And like you said, if they can get more, then they will get more. And they're going to spin the conversation that way.
Because we don't want to say we're okay with only one.
Exactly. It's just really, he's really good at his job.
It sounds like what you're saying is the business school, you seem to be implying here, Sabina, I don't want to put you on the spot, but it seems like you're implying that business school is sociopath training.
Oh, it's 100%
that. There you go. Okay, I didn't want to take you out of context there.
No. It is that, and I'm in it, so I don't know how much of a sociopath I'll be by the end of this, but it really, really teaches you, and especially when you go and you listen to a corporate company talk about their, let's say, sustainability plans, somehow they make you believe that they're really amazing when you've read everything that they're so terrible at. For example, I think it was Stefan that went to he went to Globe, and he said the CEO of Nestle was talking about sustainability when pretty much every single environmentalist hates the company.
Oh yeah, he's on my list he's in the top three of worst people on earth.
Yeah. But however, on paper or what it would seem from a communications point of view, Nestle is really, really sustainable as a company.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between actually trying to make a difference and a business's point of view as to what sustainability means.
Yeah. So let's come back though. I'm going to come back to the lemonade stand thing. So the other thing there's two other things I want to cover quickly in this, and then we'll go to a music break. So one of them was that he's talking about, so they're really trying hard to brand that Canada could be the world's clean energy supplier. And so what he's talking about was, there has been some development. I mean, the oil sands and with the help of the Alberta government has been pumping billions of dollars into carbon alleviation type technologies at various things. Some of them involve getting more energy, like using waste energy to put back into to alleviate the power requirements of running the tar sands themselves. Some of them have had to do with making the fuel generated a little bit less carbon intensive. Some of them have involved carbon capture and storage, which is a highly questionable technology, which we'll get back to later. And the idea that come on basically seems to be his argument. But there's two things here. So we'll deal with the lemonade stand one. So the reason he's saying Canada oil lobbyists fuel running a lemonade stand with one customer, that the reason that's the title of the article is what he's saying is that essentially the Canadian oil market largely, like, it's a global market, but basically our largest customer is the U.S. And so what they're doing, you know, because there's cheap oil, especially with the embargo being lifted over Iran, there's a lot of other cheap oil being pumped into the market right now. And combining that, so that's driving down the price of oil, combined with a, you know, until somebody does something about it, resurgence in shale and a whole bunch of advances in hydraulic fracturing or fracking technology. That they're basically running out of places to sell their expensive oil. And the only way to bring it to a thing where it's still profitable for them is if they do their own processing, which requires either doing some of their own processing or getting it to international markets. So they need the pipelines to get it to a customer other than the Americans. And the Americans are quickly not needing the product as much and prices being driven down. So what they're saying is if we don't get the pipelines to be able to cheaply and cost effectively get it to ocean, so that we can ship it by sea to other customers, we're essentially going to run out of customers. And I say, good. But I was like, that's the exact point of what we've been trying to do is strand oil. And then, of course, he's saying, you know, well, and it almost seems like a threat. And he's like, well, if we don't get these pipelines, we're just going to have to do it by rail. It's the which one, of course, is, you know, it's a weird threat because we just talked about how often the pipelines leak. So yeah, it probably is worse. But it's like kind of like saying that like swallowing broken glass is not quite as bad or worse than swallowing razor blades. I mean, either one is terrible. So not great really imagery. Buying it, but there, thank you. Yes. I've been in a bit of a mood. So last thing, then we'll go to break. I'll save the other thing for later. It was a quote here. I'm going to see, I just got to skim quickly here to find it. It was right at the end. Where'd you put it? Okay, so when you look at greenhouse gas, this is a quote now from the CAPP Vice President of Communications, Jeff. When you look greenhouse gas emissions in Canada, the oil sands only represent 8.5%. He explained the other sectors that need to pull up their socks. Need to pull up their socks as well. Buildings are responsible for 12.5%, but you don't see a war on buildings, do you, Alex? Where's the war on buildings? Well, guess what? We don't have an alternative to buildings. We do have an alternative to oil. Fail. You get an F for that argument.
Well, and you can reduce that 12% down to 8%, down to 6% by keeping on innovation like in building. And that's sort of the path that we're going on, especially with a new Liberal climate change bill, mm-hmm. In Ontario anyway. And that's something we'll probably talk about later.
Yeah.
So I mean, yes, other industries need to pull up their socks, but other industries are better equipped to pull up their socks through innovation.
Other industries aren't spending hundreds of millions or billions of dollars fighting these changes, for starters. Second of all, yes, we are doing that. There is, in fact, a war on buildings, but here's the thing. It's not being as publicly fought because they're not resisting. I mean, there is some resistance, of course, and asking any industry to change involuntarily for reasons that don't have anything to do with making them more money is always going to be pushback on that. But we're seeing rapid progress. There is an alternative to buildings. And yes, actually, there is a war on buildings. It's just going more silently because they're not kicking and screaming and they're not there's no giant building manufacturing company that owns, you know, most of the wealth on the planet and is spending, you know, the GDP of a small island nation a year to fight regulations against it. So, you know, this guy sounds very pleasant, as you would if your job was to be a VP of talking. Facts don't hold up, bad arguments. And if this is the best they've got, and I think it is because this guy's job is to advertise for CAP. And it sounds like this is the best he's got, and he's got nothing. So,
Sabina, did you have something?
Yeah. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that when you're talking about other industries that are unsustainable, for example, buildings or transportation and things like this, the reason why the oil and gas industry is so unsustainable is because at its 100% at its core, its business model is based on extracting finite resources, whereas other industries don't have that problem. But when you go into mining and coal and as well as, for example, oil and gas, those are 100% extracting of resources that are finite. When you can definitely reuse materials for a building, you can recycle and you can use most of that in order to create new buildings or make new materials. However, you can't recreate like an oil well. It's just not possible. So when at the base of your business is extracting and completely removing finite resources from the earth, that is the definition of unsustainable. So there's really not much you can say to that.
Yeah, and so let's look at those numbers again, and then we'll go to a music break. So he says 8.5% is on the oil sands. First of all, these numbers are very fuzzy, and like 8.5% is only accurate in the extremely specific context that he's talking about, and this is just... anyway, it's fun with math. It's creative use of numbers. So the number itself is questionable, but let's take it at face value. Fine. Oil sands represents 8.5. Is that all oil use in Canada? No. Is that all oil infrastructure in Canada? No. So it's already above 8.5, but let's take them at his 8.5. If efficiency upgrades on average usually see about a 50% reduction, so 12.5, we're now at 6.25. If we implemented every possible upgrade to buildings, we're looking at about 50% power increase and more, with more expected deliberately over time with, I forget the name of that rule, but the rule that talks about computer processor speed doubling at a certain rate. Yes, it is Moore's Law. I didn't hear you on the mic, but it was Moore's Law. So let's say that. So there's a huge window of improvement there. Yes, these are changes we can do now. We have the technology now, and there's just a matter of putting them into practice. The entire 8.5% can be removed. Sorry, that's better. 8.5 is a bigger number than 6.25, and we can still do the other number too at the same time by switching to renewable energy immediately and as strongly as possible. And before you say anything about jobs, guess what makes a lot of jobs? Building a renewable energy future. All right, and we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT. 89.5 FM, CIUT, that is, 89.5 FM. Also, I'm getting back used to being back in this chair, and I did neglect one of my duties. One of my duties is, in fact, to thank very much our radio syndicate partners all the way across the country, all of the radio stations that syndicate our program, and all of the other agencies that also put out our content as well, including our partners over at rabble.ca, very appreciated, as well as all the radio stations and all the volunteers and all of you, the listeners. We love you. Thank you for listening. We're going to have a bonus show after the program a little bit today. I haven't decided what we're going to talk about yet, largely, although I am going to make a quick note about my absence and return of my health for those who are interested. Generally, it's only the really hardcore, super cool people who listen to the bonus show, so that will be just for you. I'm not going to talk about that on air. That's not related to the show, but if you're interested, I'm going to do a kind of like final actual announcement about what's going on with me. So if you've been interested why I've been away, and I may potentially be away in the future, hopefully not. You can listen to the bonus show, and then, I don't know, we'll talk about something fun in addition to that. So without further ado, however, we're going to talk now about makeup. Sabina's going to help me a little bit with this one, but there was a report being done, and it was done by the Environment Commission, the report is sort of centered around, the press release was centered around the Environment Commissioner, Julie Gelfand. And it was drawing attention to potentially hazardous chemicals in everyday consumer items. So this is not necessarily specific to cosmetics, although cosmetics is a huge issue in here. It does also include general body care products. So when a lot of the time, I know Sabina, if I say the word cosmetics, 50% of our listeners, aka the men, just sort of tune their ears out because they think, well, I don't wear, lipstick, so this doesn't apply to me. It does. It's pretty much all body care options, everything from toothpaste, your Axe body spray, you terrible human being who wears Axe body spray. Any of those other things, anything you put on from my cosmetic point of view, whether or not you consider it makeup counts, including household, and in addition to that, as well, household cleaners and all sorts of other household products. So there's a few major issues here. I'm going to outline a couple of them, and then I'm going to go to Sabina for comment. But the major one here essentially was that The biggest part of it is the proprietary ingredients lists, essentially. So it makes sense from a business point of view because of the competition in the marketplace. So specifically things with fragrances, fragrances have largely been held as trade secrets. So if you go and get your favorite perfume, there's anywhere between a few and dozens of ingredients which are not listed. And this is done for legal reasons that exempts these companies from disclosure laws because of the highly competitive nature of the fragrance industry. They got a bunch of laws passed where they do not have to disclose their ingredients list lest they give away, well, I'd say A, lest they give away their trade secrets, and B, probably because a lot of people would be grossed out if they knew what was actually in their makeup, because there's probably like dolphin urine or something like that. Almost certainly there is dolphin urine. But this is something that has a range of problems because there's a number of these things. And the issue here is that, and currently, and this is the thing that, like, I knew it, but I sort of, when I reread it, Sabina, it sort of surprised me again, which was it isn't just consumers which have this information hidden from them. It's also Environment Canada. So they literally, just by saying they can put aroma on a bottle, and Environment Canada goes, oh, well, that falls under the discretionary part of the law. We can't ask what's in it. And it turns out that a lot of this stuff has harmful stuff, including many carcinogens, many cancer-causing agents. They're saying many of these are not safe, including ones that say fragrance-free that may in fact just have a fragrance and then has an additional chemical added to mask the fragrance. Also listed on the things of the do not assume these are safe rule are things listed as hypoallergenic and unscented. For initial comments, Sabina.
I mean, this conversation is really, really widely spoken about in the chemical communities, mainly because these are products that we use every single day, but people don't have the toxicological information like based on those products. So Environment Canada may know that this is an issue, but they don't have all of the data in which they can issue, okay, now we're going to ban this product. For example, what comes to mind is the banning of microbeads mm-hmm. that was in every single one of scrubbers and face washes. And it had nothing to do with making your face cleaner. It was just kind of like it was mainly for its physical
it's impact.
Yeah, exactly. And it's shown that microbeads, because of their polymer base, like they're plastic, so they are pretty much accumulating on all of our lakes, and Canada and the U.S. have now committed to ban them completely. And this also reminds me of a topic that I've extensively researched, is nanoparticles and nanomaterials in our everyday environment. And this is probably around 10 years or 15 years away from being banned. So we're going to see a lot more of nanoparticles in our everyday materials. And one of the main ones that you were talking about, guys think that they're not really exposed to this because they don't wear makeup. It's in sunscreen. So if you ever wear sunscreen, or if you ever think that, oh, I'm trying to protect myself from the sun so that I don't, you know, get cancer, well, there's definitely zinc oxide in your sunscreen, in which it can definitely lead to very bad effects on your body. Mm. And the main thing is that nanomaterials and nanotechnology is so new, depending on what you think of as new, it's around relatively 10 to 20 years old. So not a lot of data is on its impacts on a large scale. They can only test the data or what's going to happen in the lab. If it's tested safe in the lab, it seems like it's safe, but it's not necessarily environmental effects. And that's really the main issue about nanomaterials, because now they've seen that because they're so small, they go into the DNA of plants when they're released into the environment and completely change the structure of plants. And they also go into the DNA of humans. And there's even been some deaths. But this is when people are highly exposed to this, but yeah. We will continue to be exposed to nanomaterials and all other types of carcinogens and chemicals in our cosmetics and household products, and it has to change, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, and maybe that's, before we go through to Alex here, maybe that's what we can talk about in the after show a little bit, was the thing you said there about it caused a few deaths, and it's like the thing maybe we can talk about later, we can change our minds if we want, but was just the idea of that, like, you know, people seem to only pay attention when it causes a death, but like, you know, increasing cancer rates by like 90%, so like, you know, 70 people out of 1,000 get cancer instead of 2, sort of that doesn't seem real, I guess, and so people don't respond to it. So if something is like highly toxic but just ruins your life and makes you die slowly and painfully, eventually doesn't, you know, nobody notices that. But if one, you know, baby, you know, gets very, you know, makes a good photo because blood's coming out of their nose or something and dies, then it's all over the headlines. And it really distorts our ability to actually assess risk in our day-to-day life. So maybe we can come back to that. But let's go to Alex, who had his hand up.
Well, I was just going to say plastic microbeads and plastic nano particles terrify me. I feel like even if we figure out the whole fossil fuel, like if we pare back our fossil fuel consumption, we're still at risk of destroying the planet just from these little pieces of plastic. These are like through bioaccumulation, through like covering the top of the ocean, like plastic. We all already know that plastic is contributing to destroying the oceans, but these are things we can't even see. And I'm just worried that since these are particles that'll be around for 50 years, maybe 1,000 years, we don't really know. It's going to be something that we don't realize until it's too late, that the kind of destruction that it's causing. So, I mean, I personally, the first time I heard about how potentially harmful microbeads are, I made sure to remove them from my home and not ever buy them again. And I hope that all of our listeners will take a look around for microbead containing products and do the same thing.
Yeah, very, very easy to do. There's the identical product, you know, with a minimum ask to lifestyle change. You know, we're not asking to become vegans or anything here. Is go and find the exact same product, but without microbeads. Very simple, and you're not going to save the planet, but it's the easiest thing you can do to make a difference today is to never buy microbeaded products again. Sabina?
I think the microbeads aren't really going to be necessarily a huge problem from here on out because they are banning them, and a lot of, you know, stores and companies are going towards banning them. My number one issue is that we have, like, for example, there was some recent articles online saying that a lot of the water that we drink has antibiotics and antidepressants in it that chemical waste treatment plants and water treatment plants cannot process because it's way too small. And not only is that the same with all of the medical waste that's in our drinking water, but it's the same with nanoparticles and nanotechnology, and we're constantly consuming this, and it's really, really hard to move away from this topic because it is all around us because of the way that we have moved ourselves to. So even though we think that technology is the answer and innovation is the answer, the people that are creating these new innovations really have to look really well at the data of what's happening after this is released into the environment or into the atmosphere. Because if you don't do that full circle check, especially when it comes to chemicals, then it can really harm more than do good.
Yeah. So I want to keep get back on track. We went the first a little long in the first section, so we'll cut this section a little short so we get back on the timing track. So the very last thing about that, first of all, I want to make a note for anyone who thought that, look, Darren threw to Sabina because it's about cosmetics, so the girl's going to know more about that. No, it's because she knows more about science than I do. Notice that? Notice that. Thank you, Sabina, for providing information which I do not have off the top of my head, which you totally did because I didn't warn you about that until 10 seconds before. So you should be impressed. That was pretty good. So let's move on. So there was more about that. We were also talking about later in that article. Again, this will all be posted on the website as well. There was a further part of the report, which also goes on and talk about the resilience of infrastructure in response to climate change, and a venom tooth, I might say a little bit, pulling no punches, criticism about the spending on mitigation projects. So from the Environment Commissioner. So it's good. She's this Environment Commissioner has actually impressed me quite a bit today. Anyway, we'll see how long that lasts. Another quick one, which we'll have on the website. Maybe we won't have time today. Maybe we will, but I'll just mention it now in case we don't get back to it as well, there was another article, which again, I will also post about most Canadian seafood fails harvesting sustainability tests. So again, the same thing, just a general theme here of regulation not being up to snuff. And the thing I get here is the idea is that you know, nag a parent nagging a child to like clean their room or something like that. It's something that's so annoying to do. Regulation, oversight. God, I mean, we have to make sure every cookie doesn't have more than 4 chocolate chips in it. But look, this is really important, and we have to be adults. And that means we have to do this stuff, and that means we have to pay for it. Because the impact of not paying for it means you get sick. Or, you know, heaven forbid you, you know, pass away because somebody else, you know, thought it was going to do, you know, it was too much to spend an extra, you know, 2% of their product cost to make sure it wasn't giving everybody cancer. So we have to be adults about this. Regulation and oversight matters. Companies obviously won't do it themselves. Anyone who thinks they will is a fool. I'm sorry, because you've never read a newspaper in your life. So we need to make sure that we're regulating and controlling these companies properly, whether they be fish companies, oil companies, or, you know, environmental branding, you know, green seal of approval companies. All of these things need oversight, and we have to be responsible about it. So let's take our second break right there. We'll come back with a couple of pieces of sort of good news. All right, we're back. You're listening to The Green Majority here in the final section on CIUT 89.5 FM. All of our wonderful radio and community partners all the way across the country now into the United States, as well our wonderful partners over at rabble.ca who have been helping to promote our content and our podcast for quite some time now. Thank you very much to them as well. And also just a continuous, basically, shout out to the National Observer for doing great work as well. Always a lot of content available to be found there. If you don't feel like listening to the show, you can basically go read one of those sources, either Rabble or National Observer, and you'll find about a third of our news articles we source. Probably about a third. A lot of the rest of them come from The Guardian or international sources or mainstream media sources that we then just have to reinsert some commentary into because they leave out the juicier parts. But there you go. So we're going to go now to our sort of good news with an asterisk portion of the program today. I will be providing the asterisk. So for the good news portion, Sabine Hassani.
Yeah, so again, this is an article. So the National Observer recently posted an article on one of the largest oil companies in the world, which is Shell Canada, walking away from a large part of their oil and gas reserves in the Canadian Arctic. And this announcement was made at the Ocean Summit for Oceans Week last week, hosted in Ottawa by WWF Canada in order to allow the government to protect the region and the local communities and the species nearby in those areas where Shell had the licenses to drill. So what's really interesting is that Shell Canada is also facing legal challenges by WWF beforehand to cancel these leases. And they say that they received no compensation or tax receipts for what they did. And Michael Crothers is the president of Shell Canada. He dismissed any questions, of course, when asked about the transfer of the leases, if it was due to the lawsuit or not. And he responded that they had already been negotiating with the government of Canada to give away these leases beforehand. And the negotiations were motivated mainly by an announcement in December where the Liberal government promised to protect 10% of the country's marine areas. I personally think 10% is what 10%? I mean, we live in a country that is so amazing and is so amazing in its environmental abundancy. How are you going to only promise to protect 10%? But that's another story. So in the meantime, people are really, really happy with this decision. However, Crothers and Shell Canada say that they're not completely giving up drilling in the Arctic, and they're looking at the North on a case-by-case basis, which is, so it says, his specific comment says, we have to look at our opportunities in the North on a case-by-case basis, and we still have that in our portfolio. In fact, there's a natural seepage of oil and gas in the Baffin Bay area, and so on and so forth. And they're just pretty much saying, here, you can have this little bit, and we're going to make you happy, but wherever we see that there's a large reserves of oil, we still want to go there, and we're not completely giving up Arctic drilling rights.
Yeah. So the sarcastic, cynical view of this says, well, they didn't really want it anyway. And they're not saying anything about other projects. So, you know, they're framing this not as a activism win. And I question that it really was. I think this probably was something they didn't want. However, I'm going to asterisk my own asterisk and say that being said, the traditional, way of operation for these companies is the you know, get away peasant sort of response, and they just sort of don't do anything. Now, I think the positive news here, I don't think, is the news. I think the positive news here is an indication of the larger story that's going on. And the indication of the larger story here that's going on to me is that this says that even the biggest companies now are choosing their fights. They're picking which things they want to fight on and which ones they don't. And that's a concession that these fights are effective. And it's a concession that they have, that their resources are being strained. So from two things. One, the political will to oppose them is not only there, but is there in a way that they know it's there. And so they're not going to, they're in a position now where they have to pick their fights. And the other thing as well is that simply the cost of fighting it is costing them enough money. So it isn't really just about the PR at this point. I think they've accepted that there's a certain portion of the public who's just going to think they're Satan no matter what they do. And I think that's their attitude, and I'm not even sure that's wrong. But regardless of that, any fights, that there's a chance they could lose. And because there's a chance they could lose any specific fight, they now have to consider the cost of those fights, which means that they're going to preemptively pick some of their fights. So is the abdication of these rights, a victory? Okay, technically. But I wouldn't, I'm not going to go buy a celebratory ice cream cake tonight or anything. However, I think as part of an ongoing battle, this is more indication that we're winning. And so I think what that means is redouble your efforts, right? Keep at it, because this pressure is working. It's continuing to work. And whether it be because you've upset the local community enough that there's enough local resistance to these projects, or just enough general public awareness of the fact that there are alternatives to these projects, this is going to continue to push them in the right direction. And again, I will say again, just because it's been a theme, and especially I don't want to be a bad sort of winner here and go, ha, screw you oil people and all the people who work there. No, we're all Canadians and we all deserve to have a good job. I would just prefer that the people who work in the oil sands were given the resources, training, and job retraining and resources to be able to transition into clean energy jobs. I want all of those people to be employed and have their families and have their little 2-year-old's bubble bath or whatever in the backyard. I just don't want them to earn their money from doing that by something that's going to hurt all of us, including their own kids, later in the future. So I will leave it there. We're going to go now to Alex, who wants to tell me a little bit about some other good news I should be happy about, theoretically. Let's see if I remain happy.
There we go. So I'm going to talk about an article about a really cool experiment that was happening in Iceland, where they were working on turning CO2 gas from electrical emissions back into stone, solidifying it. So what the process was they pumped CO2 gas mixed with water into volcanic rock, basalt specifically. The basalt contains minerals that react to the carbon dioxide to form carbonate, which is a mineral that makes up limestone. And the researchers, this was sort of a trial thing. The researchers were predicting that it would take over 100,000 years for the gas to turn into stone. And they were shocked when, in this particular trial, it only took 2 years. So all of a sudden, everybody was excited, like, hey, maybe we've solved climate change. We can just turn all of this gas back into stone. So this is one of many carbon capture and storage techniques, or CCS for short. Traditionally, in CCS, they're pumping gas into empty oil reservoirs. But the worry with this has always been, is the gas going to leak out someday? And just cause carbon emissions at some point in the future. So this Iceland project, now that it's been successful, they're scaling up to 10,000 tons of carbon dioxide per year, which is great. To like put that in context, there's like hundreds of millions of tons emitted every year. So it's a very small portion, but they're saying that they could transfer this technique to anywhere on the globe where there's this basalt rock and volcanic activity, some notable examples being the west coast of the United States and India, which has a huge basalt deposit and also a ton of coal power plants. Another problem with this technique is that it uses water, approximately 25 tons per per ton of CO2 that's buried. But the caveat is they think that they can use seawater effectively to instead of fresh water. So there's lots of seawater to be used.
There was also a comment there that the next largest, you know, non-volcanic specific deposits of basalt are also on the ocean floor. So if you can use seawater, you know, potentially this opens up the ocean floor, which I'll hold off my asterisk comments for a minute. But on the before we get to that section, that, you know, the potentially there's a large opportunity there, you know, asterisks.
Yeah, yeah.
Implied.
Well, yeah, what I want to say is I thought that this was really exciting and really cool. I love when there's technological innovations that can help shift, like immediately shift to reducing carbon emissions. But I mean, this is sort of like taking the solution that technology is going to save us versus let's shift our mindset to not emit so much carbon in the first place, that we have to come up with these things to save us from immediate or from future peril due to global warming. Sure. So I know what Darren's going to say as the main problem with this, but I'm going to let him say it.
Okay. Well, there's a couple. I warned you as to one of them. There's a couple things. So we just have a minute left here, so I'll do it kind of quickly. So the first one is I want to point out is the distinction between what they're talking about here and what's been going on in Alberta. The difference being is that when they're storing, and I'm not an expert here, so I'm doing kind of the Coles Notes version, is that essentially in traditional carbon capture and storage, the carbon is trapped within the porous rock at a near chemical level, I understand. So it's still gas, but it's not just like a balloon full of gas. It's actually, so if you popped the balloon, it all runs away immediately. It's more almost chemically bonded with the rock at the gas level. So I've had someone explain this to me, you know, quite frustratedly when I brushed off them aside that this, you know, this is not quite, you know, your understanding on how this works isn't quite accurate, and fair enough. And this seems like an even better one because, you know, my thing was, well, you can tell me it's chemically bonded all day long, but a gas in a solid structure, that still doesn't feel right to me. I'm not a chemical engineer, but it still doesn't feel right to me as something that's like long-term safe. Especially when they get it to bond through a chemical reaction that, for all we know, there could be a natural chemical reaction that could go the other way. So it could, in effect, despite their assurances, be exactly the same situation. The situation they assured me it wasn't, which was a balloon full of gas that could get popped at any time. So there is that concern, but this is different for that reason, that at least it's solid. I don't know that it being solid alleviates my initial concern, but that's an I don't know. So that's not a fair criticism. My real point here is the one about... I was trying to think desperately of a non-video game analogy because I know I use that a lot. So I did, but it's not as good as my video game analogy, but I'll spare you the video game analogy for this time. So say that you need to buy a new computer and there's updates for all the operating software and you've already spent quite a bit of money. Say you're a big company, so you didn't download a pirated copy. You went out and you bought all the gizmos for the last generation of operating systems. So let's pick on Microsoft. Let's say Windows 7. And you bought all these expansions, you got all these like custom upgrades for the thing, and you invested a lot of money in this operating system. And then a new operating system comes out that promises to completely revolutionize computing, but it's, you know, exceedingly expensive. The cost will come down over time, but it's the infrastructure for the old system is going to be phased out very quickly. Anyway, you see where I'm going with the analogy. The point is here is the fact that you could continue to get usefulness out of the old operating system by buying upgrades and things that, you know, do some of the stuff that the new things do. And maybe even those upgrades are, you know, even combined are cheaper than buying the new operating system. But the sooner you get the new operating system, all of the upgrades are built in. All of the things are scale. It only gets cheaper over time as opposed to more expensive. And it's a very simple case of accounting that the sooner you buy into the thing that's going to be the next thing, it's going to be a larger upfront cost, but long-term your costs are going to be lower. And that's something that we're just really bad as people. We're bad at math. Hashtag math is hard. And they're playing on that fear. But it is not cheaper long-term to do this. And I think the sooner that we buy into the technology that's going to make all this stuff moot, we could have $10 billion worth of these solar plants running by the time they even build it. Show's over. Afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for listening to The Green Majority. Stay tuned for the bonus show if you want to hear us talk a little bit more and for me to get a little personal for a minute. Other than that, have a good green week, folks. You can check it all out, greenmajority.ca. Take care.